Human Vortex Training and Menachem Brody present the Strong Savvy Cyclist and Triathlete Podcast, where we talk strength training, physiology, psychology, tech, and much more to help you get fitter, faster, and stronger in and out of your sport, giving you expert insights, talking with other leading experts. And now, your host, world-leading strength coach for cyclists and triathletes, Menachem Brody.
Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, man. Pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on. Really excited to be here.
Well, you've been really out there and sharing your knowledge with new and also seasoned strength coaches and also sport coaches for quite some time. Can you share with the audience a little bit more about how you got into strength training and kind of leading in the education field or continuing education field for other coaches of sports and strength?
Yeah. It's funny when you say it like that, because first off, it makes me feel kind of old. It makes me reflect on why I got into this. I got into the strength training world because I was always like the smallest and youngest kid in my class. Like, I loved sports, but our school year, our calendar year started August 1 and my birthday was July 27th. So I was kind of right up against that deadline. My parents, obviously sent me to school. But that was compounded by the fact that a lot of the kids that were my age in my class at my high school were all a full year older than me because they'd been held back as well. So I'm basically like 18 months to 2 years biologically behind a lot of these kids. And I realized, get to 14, 15 years old, like, man, I'm tired of getting like beat up. Every time we play soccer or we play a baseball game or a basketball game, I'm literally the smallest person on the field developmentally. So in between my sophomore and junior years, now keep in mind, this is like the early 90s. So weight rooms in middle schools and high schools weren't really a thing. Well, we get our first weight room and it's a very Spartan setup, to say the least. We've got like one weight room that's basically next to a boiler room in our high school. And it's like mismatched weights. Like if we have 50 pound dumbbells, one's a circle and the other's a square. It's all hand-me-down stuff from the local college. So we've got that. And then on the other side, we had like this beautiful chrome, like Cybex section. So we had the leg extension, the leg curl, the leg press, the chest press. So it was like these two dichotomies. And I realized like, hey, I think if I do this and if I can get a little bit stronger, it's going to help me in my preferred sport, which was basketball. So really dedicated myself that summer. And I was doing the dumbest things ever. Like the dumbest things ever. We're talking like sets of 100. I'm doing bench press basically 3 days a week. And every Friday we were maxing out. So I'm doing all this ridiculous stuff. But the great thing about being young and just getting started in all this is that you can do anything and see progress. So even in that 6 to 8 week time period over that summer, from a basketball perspective, I noticed there was more zip on my passes. There was more range on my jump shot. And the best part was over the summer, you always have open gym. And so I had these older guys that were coming back and playing open gym. And all of a sudden they weren't pushing me around anymore. Like I could hold my ground. And then with another year of smarter training, I got a little bit smarter, obviously over that first year. And now the next summer I'm pushing them around. So I knew I was passionate about sports. I knew I was passionate about fitness. Didn't know the exact route that I would take, but did the whole undergrad. Got through undergrad, realized I hadn't trained anybody yet, wasn't ready to be a coach. So I did a master's degree. And that's when I really got into the strength and conditioning side. And so spent 2 years getting my master's degree, basically living a double life between the research lab, which is where I had my graduate assistantship, and the athletic weight room. And so that was kind of the start. And that's what got me excited about all this. But you also asked about like the education. And for whatever reason, I think it's in my blood. My mom taught horseback riding for like 35, 40 years. My dad was a professor at Ball State for like 35 years. So I think teaching and coaching are kind of in my blood to some degree. And so I knew even when I was 24, 25 years old, as I was starting to finish up that master's degree, that I wanted to give back and I wanted to share what I'd learned. So really important thing happened for me. I started writing these articles for a small powerlifting magazine. And then in 2003, I actually went to a nutrition conference with my wife. The place where she was working was basically giving us room and board. So, okay, you know, I'll go up to Chicago and hang out for a weekend. And the first presentation that she wanted to see was some guy named John Berardi. Like, oh, wait, I know this guy. He writes for T-Nation. And 2003, T-Nation was really getting the ball rolling. Like, they were really starting to crush it. So I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm going to go check this out. We got there early. JB was setting up and, you know, just hit him up, started chatting with him. And he's like, oh, what do you do? I'm like, oh, well, I'm into training. You know, like you, I'm trying to write a little bit. And he just said, hey, you know, if you ever want to write for T-Nation, just email TC, who was the editor, and tell him that I sent you. And so that really kind of set the path for me. JB kind of got me into the game. And from there, I just tried to create and develop as much content as I could, because I felt like as I was learning things, it not only made me a better coach to write it or to speak it or to shoot a video on it, but it was making other people better as well. So try not to ramble too long there, but that's kind of how I got started in all this, not just from a training perspective, but from the education side as well.
Well, you used some language that was really interesting. You said you were finishing up your undergrad degree and you didn't feel ready to be a coach. So it sounded like you already knew that's what you wanted to do, but you wanted more experience. Is that what that was?
That's absolutely it. So here's the thing. I think schools are different now, but again, late 90s, I had an exercise science degree. I came out of high school and I knew I wanted to declare as an exercise science major. So I took all the classes, right? Anatomy, physiology, biomechanics. I took XPhys 401, where you're reading EKGs. I did XPhys 402, where you're learning how to take body fats and blood pressures while people ride on exercise bikes. Like I learned all of this testing and all this theory. But I'll be honest, man, I never coached somebody other than my wife and maybe some of her friends that wanted a workout routine. I never coached people throughout my entire undergrad career. So that's when I knew, like, hey, I think I want to be a coach or I want to be a trainer, but I have zero experience. So that's why I knew, like, okay, number one, I need more experience. I need to figure out if this is really what I want. So that was part of the interest in the master's degree. And I also knew, like, let's be frank, at 21 years old, I was very immature. So I knew that I wasn't ready to go out in the real world, get a job yet. So I figured, hey, this is two more years where I can get better at my craft. I can hopefully get some coaching experience. And quite frankly, I just needed to grow up quite a bit in those 2 years. So that's kind of what led me back to school, got me the master's degree, and most importantly, really got my feet wet as a coach during that period of time.
And during that undergrad, were you like interning anywhere? Were you working with the S&C department, or was it just, I think you did an ACSM accredited program for your undergrad. Is that right?
Yeah. So Ball State was very ACSM heavy. So almost on like the, I don't know, it was very fitnessy, for lack of a better term. There was not a lot of S&C background. I think I had one weight training class that I had as a senior. But I mean, look, I had zero coaching experience. So my experience during that time, I didn't intern. I just feel like the path and the structure weren't really there at that point in time. Now we have master's programs in strength and conditioning, right? There's entire fields and tracks geared towards strength and conditioning. That wasn't really the path that I had back then. So my experience for those 4 years was basically being a gym bro, right? Trying all the routines from muscle and fitness and flex, and ultimately like Muscle Media, right? If you remember that when Muscle Media spun off and they kept the online version, but then TC and them started T Nation. So that's what kind of started to spin me into this world of, hey, there's more to this than just bodybuilding. But yeah, that first 4 years, it was trial and error and a lot of bodybuilding programs and basically just trying to figure things out for myself.
But also the ACSM program, like I went through Pitt, which was also ACSM accredited. It's not easy. Like it gives you the clinical skills, the hands-on. So you really had, you got put through the fire without having that training experience. You weren't even working as like an ACE certified personal trainer. You were just going through the undergrad. So you really, like that's a lot of work to put in and to have that. And then to have the state of mind to say, I'm not ready to coach yet because I don't have experience. that's a far cry from where a lot of people are. Most people take an online, take it until you pass test and say, oh, I'm a certified personal trainer. And then I think you and I have both seen the results of that.
Yeah. Well, look, I remember coming out with my master's degree and I was interviewing at a big box gym. And I remember very clearly, it was like my second or third interview, right? And I wanted to be in Indianapolis. Like my wife and I, she was my girlfriend at the time, but we really wanted to be in Indianapolis. And I remember sitting in this big box gym, and in the room next to me is another guy. And I knew him because he went to Ball State, and an incredibly lean guy. I mean, this guy was jacked, but I knew he didn't know jack about actually training or coaching people. And so I just had this thought of, so wait, we're going to come on the floor at the same time and he'll probably do better than me because he looks the part more than I do. Like I was by no stretch of the imagination unfit, right? But I didn't look like this guy. He was like legit 5-6% body fat. So that's when I was just like, this isn't really going to be my scene or my gig. So yeah, I mean, I just knew, number one, I needed more coaching experience. And I also knew like going forward, like I wasn't going to be the guy that hangs his hat on being 5-6% body fat and just looks great, but knows nothing about training. Like I was always passionate about learning and about educating myself so I could be the best trainer or coach possible.
Absolutely love it, man. I mean, that seems to be even today a very rare thought process. A lot of people want to be the best or have the biggest Instagram followers nowadays, whatever it may be. And the process of becoming a better coach and learning seems to be few and far between. Now, you know, you fast forward a couple years and you've been taking interns, what, since 2010, 2011, I think, is that right?
Yeah, so we opened 2008, our first intern. Yeah, the original intern, we called him Nick the Intern, was in the spring of 2009, was our first intern.
So how did you go from your process of how do I even compete with this guy who looks the part to now looking for interns and finding, were you looking for the same qualities that you had? Were you looking for certain trends? Like how did you make that turn from getting into the field where a lot of people are looking the part, but are missing that or lacking? They're not missing. They just haven't gone out and looked for it hard enough, that knowledge of how to actually train, and then finding interns to bring in to help them be able to grow and become their own professionals, not just mimicking the Mike Robertson system.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a great question, first of all. So let me give you kind of the standard shtick that I give when I talk about what makes a good intern. Right. So there's really three qualities. Number one, they have to be curious. If you're not asking a lot of questions, if you're not constantly questioning why we do things, obviously in a respectful manner, because I'd like to think Bill and I have had a certain degree of success over the years, but questioning like, well, why do you do that? And wanting to better understand or understand on a deeper level, then you're probably not going to be a great fit at IFAST. So you got to be curious, number one. Number two, you've got to have a strong work ethic because, I mean, when Bill and I started this, before I opened the gym, I was doing in-home training. And my first client started at 4:55 in the morning, and I would routinely not finish until 7 or maybe as late as 8 p.m. during the night. So, I mean, you can imagine those were some pretty darn long days. And then when we opened the gym, I was in the gym opening it at 5:45 and I wouldn't close generally until 7:15, 7:30. So 13, 14, 15 hour days were the norm. Bill worked 6 days a week, I think for 13 years. So hard work or just having a strong work ethic is something that we put a premium on, and nobody's going to come in there and just cruise through things. Like we deliberately make the internship challenging, not just physically, but mentally as well, because we want people to understand, like if you go and work in a commercial gym, you're going to have to work probably a split shift. If you go work at a D1 college, you're going to work 12, 13, 14 hour days. So hard work and a strong work ethic is something that we put a huge emphasis on. And then the third is something that, you know, I struggle to put out there a little bit because I don't want to put anybody off. But I feel like in this profession, you need a certain level of personality. It's very hard, especially if you've ever done one-on-one, it's very hard to go into a session with a client or with an athlete with very little or no personality. You need to be able to find common ground with them. You need to have a wide variety of interests. You've got to find what makes them tick, because let's be honest here, not everybody that walks in the gym is super excited to be there or to see you. So you have to find ways to keep it fun, to keep it engaging, to bring the best out of them. And I think having a little bit of personality, a little bit of flair, something that just makes you interesting to other people will make you a more successful intern. And I know that's kind of hard to say, because that's not something people always have a ton of control over. But I think if you're curious, you're hardworking, and you got a little bit of personality, you'll probably be a pretty successful intern.
And also be able to and willing to question what people accept as the norm, right? I mean, that's not an easy thing to do. Be like, well, actually, it depends. People will, why does it depend? Men's health, you know, they list off all of these resources and you're like, well, look at the sample size. And do you work at all with your interns at reading research articles and being able to kind of figure out how to apply them or what it's saying? Or is there not so much focus on the quote unquote, I can't see it here, but air quotes, scientific approach?
Yeah. I wouldn't say we sit down and like teach them how to read research. But we do teach them, you know, how to question things that they've always learned, or things that they've taken as common knowledge, right? Because a lot of the stuff that we do could be seen as controversial, or it could be seen as different. But what you'll find is a lot of the stuff that's out there, there's a certain vein of truth to a lot of stuff that's out there. But you also have to question, okay, well, when is this applicable and when is it not? And we always talk a lot about context and how important context is. So, you know, maybe this exercise is the best in a certain context, or this set rep scheme is the best in a certain context. But you've got to be able to take and understand all of that information so that you can make more informed decisions. And that's something that we really try and stress, is like, we want to teach our interns kind of our system and our approach, which frankly is challenging because there's a lot of nuance and detail to it. And we don't have as much time as we would like, but you know, ultimately, as they go through this, hopefully they're not only going to have a base level of understanding, but they're going to have those skills to where they can question the norm and they can question, okay, if this isn't working, what should I try instead? And I think the thought process and teaching them some of those critical thinking skills is probably the most important part of the internship as a whole.
So let's dive into that a little bit, because that's really deep what you just touched on, is the nuances and the different times when something is applicable. Nowadays in cycling and triathlon in particular, we have a number of coaches, and I've put my flag in the floor kind of to say that there are coaches out there giving strength programs that should not. They don't have a right to. They've read maybe one book and go with it. And that's not saying that they should stop. It's a matter of, hey, this is where we are right now. This is what I understand, and this is what we're going to go with. How do you get through to either the interns or those listening who are coaches who really want to learn and understand a little bit better how and when to apply these things and how to read those nuances? How do you get that across to them? And what would one or two really big important points you say for the listeners to begin to understand that nuance and how to apply it?
Well, first and foremost, experience is going to reign king here. Right? So like, you can't understand nuance until you've had some failures. So when you first get started, let's use myself as an example. When I first started writing programs, I was into powerlifting. So I thought, for whatever reason, that I could be objective and that, you know, even though I was a powerlifter, you know, I could write a non-powerlifting program for someone else. But looking back, you know, oh, a fat loss client, oh, they're going to squat, bench, and deadlift with a barbell. Oh, muscle building. Oh, squat, bench, deadlift, powerlift, like athlete. Like that was like kind of our viewpoint for everything. So I think some failures and some struggle, first and foremost, will give you a good idea as to why nuance is important, right? And why certain things work for some people and don't for others. The other thing that I would say is just having a more holistic perspective and approach to the strength training game at this point. I mean, a lot's changed in 20 years. When I got into like the Division I setting, it was very, very barbell heavy and was very strength emphasis. So you basically came from one of two paths. If you were in a certain school, you were generally a more Olympic lifting based program, or if you were from a different college, you were a more powerlifting based program. So that's kind of the whole offshoot of your entire program. Was it mostly the Olympic lifts, or was it mostly the power lifts? And then the accessory stuff kind of fell where it may. So now I think we can take that step back and realize, wow, that's a pretty linear path to creating a strength program for an athlete. And we need to understand, man, strength is a tool at the end of the day, right? Like, we're support staff. So if I train a basketball player, I'm not the main dish. I'm not the steak or the chicken or the fish. I'm like the mashed potatoes or the broccoli. Same thing in your world, I would assume. Like, hey, the primary goal is to run fast or to cycle fast, whatever the case may be. So your job, if you're running a strength training program, is to supplement that, to make sure that they do stay healthy or they do maybe improve their performance a little bit. But I want to circle back before we stop about one thing that you said about people that you know shouldn't be writing programs. And this is something that I've struggled with a lot, because I've seen in a lot of cases a program and I'm just like, this is trash. This is an absolute trash program. They put no effort, no thought into it. But the older I've gotten, the more I've realized, like, hey, number one, maybe they did put thought into it and this is the best that they could do, right? Because they haven't taken the time and they haven't learned this stuff. But there's levels to everything. So the level of nuance that I put into a program may not matter to a 13-year-old kid. They just want to get bigger and stronger and maybe look good for the ladies. Whereas for an NBA athlete whose body is their livelihood, they totally get, oh, wow, there's a lot of little details in here that are really important for me and for my body. So I think that's really something that's important to note. Like, the amount of time and attention to detail that you put into a program is probably commensurate with the level of athlete you're coaching versus, you know, the kid that just wants to have bigger muscles and look good on the gram. He can pay anybody to write him that program. Does that make sense?
It does. And I love that you pointed that out, because I answer that privately for listeners. It's more of a conversation point, but the specific people I'm talking about, and I'm sure you've run into many more of these where you see the program and that's the first thought is, okay, this is pretty basic. I understand where they're coming from. And then you ask, I'm like, oh, well, I read all about strength training. I read this one book by so-and-so, so I don't need to read anymore. That's the type of person I'm talking about, is they're not willing or interested in learning. It's more of, well, it's another revenue stream for me. It's like, bro, it's not a revenue stream. This is someone's body. Like, they're already beating themselves up in a sport. If you can't write one, it's not your fault. We don't know what we don't know. I look at programs I wrote even a year ago, I'm like, what was I thinking, right? What was the order? Why would I do this? And then you look back at the notes, you're like, oh, wow, okay, I wouldn't do that anymore. And then that goes into the experience bucket. But there's a number of trainers out there, you look at their programs for every single, and I'm not talking about the bodybuilder ones, but their programs are exactly the same. Like sets of 12, sets of 15. Yeah. That's it. That's the only tool in the box. And then they wonder why they're having such high client turnover, because their clients are getting injured. That's kind of what I'm getting at. So I love that you picked that up. Let's dive into that a little bit more. How would you look at, or how should a coach, what are the three anchors or four anchors they should look at when building a program? And we're brand new. We've heard a little bit about strength training. We don't really know that much. What are the three or four considerations that they have to take, that we have to take, to make sure, one, we're learning, and two, we're helping that athlete with the best to our knowledge at that point?
Yeah. Well, I think the first one, and nothing else is even close, but if you're going to be a successful coach, you have to get very clear on what is the goal for this program. And this is something I've talked about for many, many years. But I think a lot of coaches, a lot of trainers wrap themselves in this circle of, oh, I like this exercise. I like this exercise. I like this set rep scheme. Ooh, I saw this on Instagram today. I'm going to take that. And, you know, it's just like this collection of parts, right? It's like a program Frankenstein, versus getting really clear on, hey, I'm going to take a step back and say, hey, okay, this guy's had knee pain for 6 months. The only goal of this program is to get rid of the knee pain. Or this guy has too much body fat to be competitive in XYZ sport, so I've got to get some body fat off him. So the parameter, the stipulation that I put on interns, at least initially, because they get overwhelmed, right? They don't have a filter yet. So I always tell them, if you could only accomplish one thing with this program, what would it be? And so immediately now they have to look at that program in a different light. So I think that's arguably the most important thing, is get very, very clear on what is the one goal of this program. Then the other thing that I will say on top of that is that be very clear in the sense that one program is just one program. So you can't achieve all of the things in one training program. So let me use basketball, because I train a lot of basketball guys. But, you know, when a basketball player comes to me, we may need to improve how they move. So let's just call it movement quality, for whatever you want to take that as. Let's say they need to improve movement quality. They want to improve their vertical jump. They need to add some muscle and they need to improve their conditioning. So let's say we've got four goals. Well, that's fine, but we can't train for all of those things in the first program. What you end up doing is canceling a lot of the good stuff out, because you're chasing multiple goals. So instead, what I try and explain to people is, hey, look, if you want those four things, I can give you all four and you'll have that at the end of the off season, but I can't do that all in one program. So I think that's really important as well. It makes your program design much clearer. It affords you time to kind of build an athlete in a sequential fashion versus just trying to dump everything on people at once. So I think those are some of the most important things. And then if I can mention one other thing, I think when I got into this, I thought of myself very much as a strength and conditioning coach, or as a performance coach. That was a really hot word maybe 10 or 15 years ago. If you don't want to call yourself a strength and conditioning coach, you're a performance coach. And while I don't necessarily hate the term, I don't necessarily love it either, because it makes us feel as though, oh, hey, my job is to improve performance. And by that, I mean, oh, they've got to be faster. They got to be stronger. They've got to be more agile, whatever KPI you're using. It's a performance-based outcome. And let's be real here. A lot of times, if you're working with high-performance clients or athletes, your primary goal is to not screw them up. I mean, that's just the bottom line. Like, I work with high-level people in basketball, soccer, baseball, football over the years. These people have God-given gifts that we could only dream of. So first and foremost, our goal is to keep them healthy so that they can go out and perform at their highest levels, whether that's in practice or in games. And then as an extension of that, you allow them to do those two things long enough and they're going to make more money and collect more paychecks, which I'm pretty sure all of them want to do. So I know it's kind of a roundabout answer, but have a goal, a very clear goal. Understand that in each program, you're probably going to only achieve one goal. So you probably need a little bit of time to sequence all of them and put all those pieces together. And then ultimately, do no harm. And I know that's cliche, but that's kind of my viewpoint on all of this. Like, if you improve performance, that's a huge bonus. But especially the higher level you go, the most important thing is to do no harm. Keep them healthy. Keep them at a point where they can train and compete at a high level. And chances are you're going to have very happy clients and athletes on your hands.
Well, it's cliche because that's what the best coaches are doing, right? It's not a matter of, oh, that's right. So cliche. It's like not a faux pas. It's something that's so integral that everybody knows it, but yet so few people actually follow that. They're thinking, oh, well, we're going to squat this much weight and we're going to deadlift. And one of the things that's really interesting is you're very focused on the process and not doing any harm. Yeah. It's more of taking a step back at the big picture and looking at it and saying, hey, what's the one linchpin for this athlete right now? That's what it sounds like, at least. Is that about right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And keep in mind, like, I'm biased. I would always train to keep my athletes healthy, but I would probably push the gas pedal a little bit more if I was training some of the younger kids that come into IFAS, like Eric, the gentleman that trains most of our young athletes. Man, he needs to give them a little bit of juice, because the fastest kid ain't coming to IFAS for speed and agility training, right? You're getting little Johnny that's an amazing jump shooter but has slow feet, or little Susie who is great on a soccer pitch and moves really well and is great on the ball but can't get past anybody. So, like, that's my focus, because there is a bias, but you have to figure out, okay, what are the limiting factors for this client or athlete? And at the highest levels, rarely is it an output-based thing. Like if you're on the low end, maybe. But in most cases, it's, hey, how can I keep this guy healthy? How can I make him move a little bit better side to side? How can I make sure that his knee doesn't flare up midway through the season and cause him to miss 10 or 15 games, fall out of the rotation, and then he doesn't play anymore? In your space, because I have worked, you know, with a fair amount of endurance athletes over the years, it's, hey, how do I just give them enough resiliency to support their training? Like, that's such a huge piece in your space. Like, people know how to write endurance programs, and I'm sure they're getting better and better. I don't follow that world nearly as much. But a big piece is, as your training volume goes up, how do you keep your body healthy so you don't blow up? So that's kind of always my mindset and my thought process is, how do I support the training and the competition so that they can continue to get better and better? Because, I mean, that's one of the biggest things. And I've been in basketball, I've been around endurance sports, I've been in powerlifting. One of the biggest issues is when people get injured, they have to take time off, they lose fitness or they lose certain skills. And so then they have to rebuild again. So my thought process is, hey, how can I have as little time off as possible in the sense of how can I manage or stave off any potential injuries so that my athletes can continue to train and compete at the highest levels. And over time, they're going to accrue better and better results.
Want to learn more? Check out humanvortextraining.com for more on this topic from Coach Brody and today's guest.
You just turned it into a really important point. And this is where, in my opinion, a lot of people in the strength training for endurance athletes right now are really screwing it up because we don't know any better, right? I've had four clients, new clients in the last 6 weeks for my program for their back. We had Stu, McGill, Dr. McGill here. Yeah. I mean, who, you know, really well as well. And It's interesting that a lot of people still haven't connected the dots that cyclists, most of their back pain occurs because they're spending all this time out on the bike, you know, 10, 12 months or 10, 11 months out of the year. Then they hit the gym. And there are these well-meaning coaches, and that's the most important thing, I think, is no coach is out there to injure anybody. They're just doing the best they can, But they're giving them these, you know, they're throwing in this functional, progressive overload, 10-week heavy lifting program where the tissues just aren't ready. That's not resiliency. That's just beating the crap out of the body. How do we as coaches combat that and help to educate that, hey, we want resiliency. If you want to be a Tour de France rider, that means you need to train and race for 5 to 7 years straight with almost no lost training days or quality lost training days.
Yeah.
How do we get that message through?
Man, this is a great question. And I know this is something that you 100% buy into. First off, it's getting away from this mindset of, hey, we're going to crush it for 10 weeks and then you're going to get on your bike for the next 10 months, right? Like, we have to get out of this all or nothing mindset. So, hey, we can have like a base building, and there's nothing wrong with that, because there is a time where you have to get off the bike or you have to get off the basketball court or get off a soccer pitch. And the physical preparation piece needs to kind of take, it needs to take center stage. But from there, and this is important in every sport, once you've built that, you have to do everything you can to preserve that. And it sounds like in a lot of ways, cycling or endurance sports are similar to soccer. Soccer's competitive season can be gruelingly long. I mean, I've had athletes whose off seasons have been as little as 3 weeks. And let me tell you, there's not a lot you can do in 3 weeks for somebody. But your goal is, hey, during this off season, we're going to get you off the pitch, the court, the bike, whatever, out of the pool, and we're going to focus and build strength. We're going to do it in the right way. We're going to focus on the areas that you need it the most. But here's the real thing. You can't forget about it the next 10 months. You have to make a commitment to it throughout the year, because otherwise, like you said, then, you know, you take 10 months off the weight room and then you try and go in week one or week two. Generally, it's not week one. It's the second week that catches up to you, that accumulated fatigue and soreness. And that's when something breaks, right? You have a disc issue or your knee starts to flare up or whatever. So you have to commit to it as a year-round process. And I remember when you were on my show, you said, hey, look, twice a week, 15 minutes. I mean, that's pretty reasonable, but you owe me these exercises. It's a small commitment, but man, if you just stay with that over the course of the year, That's where you see the benefit. It's not in that first 10-week program. Yeah, that helps, but you've got to maintain it throughout the course of the year, and even maintain maybe a little bit far-fetched. If nothing else, I use the analogy of it's like tying a knot at the end of the rope and you're kind of hanging on. You're just trying to maintain those gains as long as you can. And then if you have a little window, maybe middle of the year or something like that, where your competitive sport can take a backseat, that's where you ramp up, even for like a short 2 to 3 week period. And then you tie that rope again and you hang on to those gains as long as you can.
And you touched on something. People here in Europe get it much more, that soccer and cycling are and triathlon are very similar. Because the soccer season here, a lot of people in the States think of sports as seasonal, right? So soccer season is summer. Like, no, that's not how it works. No. But how do we get through the mentality? You know, here's a quote from someone who just messaged me the other day. On the flip side, it is that time to start a new build for the next year soon, off the bike for 10 weeks while I do nothing but strength train for a 10-week block, which will take me to my new base in January. It's really a culture change, right? I mean, it's not just how did you fight that? How are you fighting for that with these footballers or soccer players, rather? Is it common knowledge at this point, or are you still finding there are very old school coaches or quote unquote performance coaches running those programs where you're like, man, how do I get through to this person just enough that this athlete can stay healthy and do what they need to do on the pitch?
Yeah, this is a tough one because I've seen all ends of the spectrum. I've seen the people that are 100% bought in. They fully believe in what we do. I've seen people that are total opposite. They have zero regard for strength and conditioning. They don't really care about what I do. They see it as kind of an afterthought. And then I've had the people in the middle. So as far as instilling a culture and getting people to buy into this, first off, you need to take any of your enthusiastic early adopters and run with them, right? So if I'm in a team environment, if I got 5 dudes that are all in, I'm investing a lot of time and energy into them because they want to be there. And hopefully a couple of them have some success, whether that's staying healthy, whether that's improving their performance, whatever the case may be. Over time, generally you can win more and more over. Now there's always that little subset people that, you know, for whatever reason, maybe it's a cultural thing. Maybe they're just kind of haggard. They're at the end of their career. They've never done it. So they don't see the value in it. What I do is with those types of people, I just show up every day, right? Like I'm going to give those people a fist bump. I'm going to talk to them. I'm going to chat them up. I'm going to ask them if they need anything. Because what's funny is those people don't need you until they need you, right? So like I'm having a flashback of this 2-year span I had with the Indy 11, and the coach at the time wasn't huge into strength and conditioning. They only used us like once a week. And I had a certain sect of guys that just weren't that into working out. They were established veterans. They are on the tail end of their career. But all of them started to have injuries, right? Lo and behold, here we go. Oh, this guy's back hurts, or oh, this guy's got a sports hernia. So now it's impacting their ability to play their sport. Now they'll talk to me, right? And so all of that currency that I built up over the last couple weeks or months or years, whatever the case may be, now they feel comfortable enough to say, hey man, my back's really bothering me. What can you give me? Now I've got to have the goods when it's time to show them what's up. So that's kind of the way I look at it, is the people that are early adopters, highly motivated, man, I'm going to work with them. We're going to get high quality stuff in and we're going to make them better. The guys that are a little bit more resistant or a little bit demotivated to change, for lack of a better term, it's going to be a slower approach. And I'm going to try and help them whenever and wherever I can. And I just know and understand, look, man, not everybody's going to be into this part of it as much as I am. There's a reason I am a strength coach and not playing professional basketball. Right. So I understand that and I'm conscious of that. And I just try and meet each person where they're at with regards to improving their fitness or their performance.
Well, let's take that into the mid-season. You just touched on a great point in that you have different personalities. And it sounds to me that there's a trend here. And maybe perhaps one of the required readings for interns is Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Yes.
There's a lot of communication there. And you talked about building that currency. Is that something you spend a lot of time developing with your interns and coaches that you bring on staff?
I mean, I think this is arguably the most important thing. So give you a little insight into our internship process. The first 2 weeks of the internship, we legitimately tell our interns you are to do zero coaching. I don't care what you think you know. I don't care how long you've exercised, how good you think you are at working out, zero coaching. Because number one, I don't know what you know. And number two, the way you do things may be different than how I want it done. So what we basically tell our interns is the first 2 weeks of the internship, you're there to help pick up and clean up, but most importantly, you're there to start learning about the clients and athletes that come into IFAS. And probably a better way to think of that is you're there to learn about the human beings that come into IFAS. So we're not talking set rep schemes. We're not talking exercise selection. We're talking, hey, what's your name? What's your job? How did you get into that? Do you have a family? Oh, you have kids. How many kids? How old are they? What interests do you have outside of working out? Like that stuff, that emotional capital goes so much further down the line. So like I have athletes that I've worked with 4 or 5 years now that I feel like I'm just now really starting to get to know because they're just a little bit quieter. They're a little bit more reserved. So I always try and just meet them wherever they're at. And I think that's one of the biggest things you can learn as a coach is, hey man, everybody's got different levels of enthusiasm for this. And it doesn't matter whether it's a fat loss client or a professional athlete. They come in the gym for you. Like some people are going to really be into it and they're going to be on every day and some people aren't. But you just try and match their energy level, match their enthusiasm, and just try and always be like a really positive resource for them. Because I mean, we talked about this before the show started, but I think there's enough negativity out there. I'm just going to try and be a really positive beacon for every client, every athlete that walks in my gym. I want them to feel like, hey, even if I didn't have, you know, all my energy today, or my swagger wasn't really high when I walked in the gym, I still had a productive session and they feel better when they walk out.
That's such an important thing to tie that positive experience and just anchor it. And just every time add a little bit. That's hard to do though, because there's so many external factors, right? So yeah. How do you kind of set that environment? How, you know, what's the tone? Is it music? Is there no music? Is it how the individual is greeted or the process of them coming through to get started in the gym? Like how does that happen? How do you ensure that there's some type of anchor for when they come in each time for a session?
Yeah. So first and foremost, it starts with the people in the gym, right? And we always ask our staff, first thing, within 5 seconds, when somebody walks in the gym, you greet them by first name. Because I think this is probably a Dale Carnegie thing, but the most important sound in somebody else's vocabulary is their own name, right? Or it's something along those lines. I probably misrepresented it. But everybody wants to hear their name, right? Like it just kind of like wakes you up. So we always talk about within 5 seconds, we want to say somebody's first name, greet them with some enthusiasm, right? Before the whole COVID thing, we talked about first name and then some form of just like physical greeting, right? Like if it's an appropriate person, it's a hug or a high five or a fist bump. Obviously COVID has kind of thrown a wrench in that, but just something like, hey, man, great to see you today. How you doing, man? So we always start with that. I think music is a huge piece. I do my best to try and cater music to who I have in the gym. That can be difficult when you have 12-year-old kids and professional athletes and like 70 and 80-year-old retired people in your gym all at the same time. But we try and find something that is generally non-threatening, yet upbeat. And then I think the biggest thing is, and this is something that I struggled with coming up, I always thought of myself as a little bit more cerebral coach. I like to think about why I'm doing stuff. I like to make sure I'm giving the appropriate cues. But for some reason, I thought that was mutually exclusive from being like the rah-rah motivational coach. I don't necessarily think of myself in that context, but I do think of it as it's part of my job to not necessarily be like rah-rah motivation guy, but it is my job to help get people where they need to be on a given day. So if I need a certain level of energy from somebody and they come in with none, okay, well, maybe I can't get them up to level 10, but maybe I can get them to a 6 or a 7 or maybe even 8, right? And that comes through, hey, let's chat a little bit. Like, hey, man, what's going on? Learning about them, learning about what's going on in their world, choosing the right music, putting them in the right group. So I think there's a lot of things that you can do as a coach to kind of pull out the best out of your athletes on any given day. And it reminds me of one of the guys that I've been working with. He's been here like 6 months. This guy's going into the NBA draft and it's been a grind, right? Because like he got here in like end of April and the draft keeps getting pushed back. It went from like July to September, October. Now it's in November. So he's been here a long time and it's been a long process. Cause you can imagine, you know, teams are reaching out to you and, you know, there's agents that want to talk to you and da, da, da. It's like, there's a lot going on. So sometimes it's just sitting down and connecting with the other human, like, hey man, your energy seems low today. What's going on? And so you have that conversation, you get this little peek into what's going on with them. And then you can better manage that workout. And sometimes, you know, hey, like he got that off his chest. Now he's good. And we can ramp it up. Or, hey, like this guy, he's just got a lot on his plate, like physically, mentally, emotionally. I need to back off today. And we need to make it more of a recovery type session so that the next time he comes in, he's ready. And that's what's fun about like my job is there's what I have written on the program for that given day. And then that person walks in and they're not ready to perform that workout the way I have it intended. This is the art of coaching is like, okay, you're not ready to do this today. That's cool. Let's go off script and let's make sure the next time you come in, you're feeling 100%. So I feel like I was a little bit all over the board, but I think that's what's exciting about what we do, right? It's like, it can be really boring if you're just writing a program and executing a program, like you're feeding something into a computer. Yeah, it could get pretty boring, but like I get excited about, all right, this is the program that I think is best. But at the same time, on a day-to-day basis, I might have to shift or pivot based on how my athlete presents.
You use the term art of coaching, and that's really what it is. I mean, literally what you just said, I just had with one of my professional basketball players today too.
Yeah.
Literally, we got through the warm-up, we got through our squats, and we were doing speed squats. He's moving well. He woke up a little bit late. And then something just, you know, we're watching, it's a virtual session, just something clicked and just turned off. I was like, dude, are you all right? Like, it just seems we went to the Turkish getup. You just kind of like turned off and he's been having a thing with one of his friends and his agent, exactly what you said. And that's where you've got to have that shift as a coach to go, okay, let's put the human first and then we'll worry about the fitness a little bit. Cause oftentimes the emotional state, I think there was a study done at either Carnegie Mellon University or somewhere around Pittsburgh or near Pittsburgh, where they looked at the rate of injury. It was extremely high when the athletes were not in a ready mental state where there was something else. Yeah. What's been your experience with that? And especially, you know, for soccer players that are going through these long seasons and it's a very mentally taxing game, just like tennis. How do you weave that into your sessions at all? Or do you leave that more to the sports psychologists?
I mean, look, I think we're all like poorly paid sports psychologists at some level, right? Like if you're a coach, the stronger a bond or relationship you have with somebody, the more they're going to kind of lean on you or look to you for advice. And especially, man, now a lot of the guys that I work with, they're in their 20s and I'm 42. Like there's like 2 decades between us. So I look at myself as one part coach and I look at myself for right or wrong as like one part mentor and just kind of listening to these guys. Because there's a lot of people in their lives, some positive, some negative, that are asking a lot of them. I look to myself as, hey, look, I'm going to be here on the strength and conditioning side, but I'm also just like your emotional support team too. And I'm lucky in the sense that I don't have very needy guys because we've all dealt with like the overly needy person in the past, and that can be kind of an energy drain. But I look at myself as like a mentor, and I want to help guide them and shape them, like whether it's finances, like being smart with their money, growing as human beings, right? Growing as young men. So I think like that's I don't think you need to be a psychologist or a psychiatrist, whatever the term is. I don't think you have to be one to be somebody that can be a positive influence and a positive role model for the people you work with. And in fact, I think that's something you should strive to be. And I know some people may disagree with me on that, but man, I've got like a small tight-knit group of athletes that I work with. And I think I do that for a reason, because they're the right guys. They've got the right mindset. They're willing to work hard. They're willing to be open and share when they have issues so that I can be the coach they need on that day, right? If somebody comes in and they will never tell you what's going on, and not that you need to know all of their dirty life details, right? But sometimes it's like, hey, man, like me and my girl are having problems. Okay, perfect. Because that tells you, all right, hey, I need to back off this session, right? You and I both know stress is stress. And the body perceives it somewhat differently, but largely in a lot of ways, it perceives stress kind of uniformly. So, hey, man, if this guy's not sleeping, he's dealing with all this stress at home, he's got other stressors outside of, you know, work, life, whatever, finances, that impacts how I coach somebody. And so that's where if somebody needs a psychologist or a psychiatrist, yes, then you need to refer that out. And if they have issues that are beyond your control, but if it's just being a caring person and giving somebody the time to listen to them and what they have going on, man, I think that's part of the job. And again, I'm totally okay if other people disagree with that, but that's something that I feel like has really aided my success with my athletes over the years, is I'm willing to listen to what's going on with them when necessary, giving them some advice, and then just them knowing that, hey man, this guy genuinely cares about me and he wants to see me be successful, not just on a court or on a soccer pitch, but in life as a whole.
I'm wondering if you had a mentor or a coach who kind of you learned that from, or was this more of, as you went through as a coach yourself, you realized that that's such a huge linchpin for long-term success, not just having an athlete and saying, oh, so-and-so is coming to my gym and working with me, and then they're gone in 2 years. Was that you went through that relationship yourself, or was it more of you came through that realization, or just who you are as a person?
Okay. So that's a good question. Part of it is my personality. I've always been the person, like, people will tell you, like, random people will just come up and start talking to me and telling me their life story, you know, somewhat unprompted. But yes, there were absolutely coaches that influenced me. And I mentioned early on about how much I loved basketball growing up. Like, I always joke around, it was my first love. I loved the sport of basketball. I loved playing basketball. I was like 13, 14 years old with VHS tapes, breaking down game film. Like, I was obsessed. Like, I thought I was going to be a basketball coach before I thought I would be a fitness coach. But I had a coach in basketball for 3 out of my 4 years of high school that basically drove my love of the game away from me. I mean, he was a yeller. He was a screamer. He was incredibly negative. And so I had him my freshman year. Didn't have a great year. Didn't play a lot. My sophomore year, he was no longer he was the JV coach, or he was the like varsity assistant, and they had a different JV coach. And I had a great sophomore year. You know, got to dress a couple times for varsity, got to be on our sectional team. So I felt like, oh man, things are moving in the right direction here. And then the next year, so my junior year, our head coach, the head varsity coach, steps down, and now this guy is our varsity coach for my last 2 years of high school. And it got so bad at the end of the year that I legitimately hated basketball. So now contrast that, because basketball in Indiana is played in the winter. In the spring, we have volleyball. So up until that point, I'd always played baseball, but I was like, I might try volleyball. This is my junior year. And it had been a very up and down basketball year. So I go and I play volleyball. And I have this guy who had played at Ball State. I mean, this dude was like 5'3". And if you know anything about men's volleyball, like, you've got to be able to get up vertically. This dude was 5'3 and could touch like 11 feet. I mean, he was a monster. And so I remember I would go into these practices, and this guy was like, he had some swagger, but it was fun. Like, he made sports fun again. And so we had a really good year. Like, I'd never played volleyball before. We went to state that year. I think we finished like 6th in state. And then come back to my senior year, up and down year. Didn't want to play basketball anymore, come back to volleyball. And We had a different coach, but again, just that positivity and that energy, and it made it fun to play sports. So I didn't think about it at the time, but that so massively influenced me as a coach, because I never wanted to be that coach that pushed people away. And it carried over into how I coach my clients and athletes in the gym, but it's even carried over to how I coach my kids now. My kids are 9 and my son's 7 today. Like, they play soccer and they play softball and basketball, and I coach them in a lot of sports. I always tell the parents when I'm coaching, I'm like, look, what I don't want to do, I never want to be your kid's last coach in this sport. So just think about that for a second. Like, I never want to be this kid's last coach in soccer or in baseball or in basketball, because I push them away. Like, that's what happened to me with basketball. And I never want that happen to one of these kids. I want them to enjoy sports. I want them to love sports. And even if they're not the best athlete or they're not the best soccer player, basketball, baseball player, it doesn't matter. I want them to love the game. And so that's a big part of me. And that's, you obviously got me a little bit fired up here, because these are emotions I have tabled for quite some time. But yeah, man, like, that coaching dichotomy and the differences between those coaches growing up absolutely shaped and influenced me as a coach.
Absolutely love it. There's so many parallels in my own experiences and yours, from being thinking basketball coach to fitness to volleyball in the spring instead of baseball, as well as that negative coaching. It was more, how did you recognize that it was the time that it was the coach that turned you away from it?
Yeah, I think I did. I think I recognized at the time, like, for whatever reason, this guy and I just, we don't jive. And it took me a long time to kind of get over that, because, like, I had to separate the coach from the sport. You know, I came back, and granted, people will laugh, but, like, I played a lot of intramural sports all throughout college. And I had some really good, like, basketball experiences. Like, I was, like, the runner-up in one-on-one at Ball State in intramural basketball. So, like, I still love the sport, and I'd grown. I'd gotten so much better. You know, we had a really good 5-on-5. We won, like, all whatever. I don't think it was all university, but we had, like, a really good year, my senior year. So it just took me a while to differentiate, like, hey, I can still love basketball, and realize, hey, this coach, he probably cared about me, but just the way he showed his caring wasn't a good fit for me. And I just knew, like, that's not the kind of coach I want to be, because I don't respond to that. So I can't coach people in that way. I lean more on the empathy side, on the emotional side. Now, granted, I'd like to think my hard skills are good enough, but I also I've been doing this long enough to realize that the soft skills are a critical piece of the puzzle, and understanding that, hey, we're not putting a program into a robot. It's not an equation, right? We're dealing with another human being, and you've got to support them emotionally on certain days to get what you want to out of them.
It's not just the physical resiliency, it's the mental resiliency as well, even more so.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, well, let's kind of bring everything together, because, and we'll definitely have to have you back, because there's a couple other rabbit holes that I really want to go down, but I don't think we have time. But how do you look at developing coaches? Because, you know, I mentioned intern a bunch of times before, and really, listeners out there, guys and ladies, when I say intern, I'm talking about us as coaches, because we really should have that mentality of being interns, right? We're still always learning. When you look at coaches today, what do you see as being the pillars, let's say 4 or 5 pillars, that really help to give coaches a solid start to progress and help a lot of athletes through their career?
Man, well, I don't know if I'll have 4 or 5, but I'll give you a couple here that come off the top of my brain. Number one would be that curiosity and that continuing education piece. So, like you, I look at programs that I wrote even as little as a year or two ago and cringe a lot of times, because I think, man, I mean, I know what I was thinking, but why was I thinking that? Why was I prescribing that exercise to that person?
Yeah.
So constantly educating yourself, right? And, like, man, our world is so new, right? Like, we learn stuff almost every day, I feel like. And there's so much information out there. So constantly educate yourself, but also find good filters to put your information through, right? This is like the blessing and the curse of the internet. It's the guy with the six pack and the great lighting talking about why you should do 1,000 sit-ups a day, you know, like, okay, whatever. But you got to have a filter to put this information through. And that's where finding really good mentors, mentors is huge. And the best part about the internet now is the fact that a great mentor is a Skype or a Zoom call away. I mean, I do mentorship calls now with people literally like across the globe. And that's pretty freaking cool when you think about it. So find great mentors to help you better understand the body, to help educate you. Respect the fact that if you want to get the most out of your clients and athletes, you have to understand them as humans. And again, I think this is cliche, but the connectedness of the world, or like the connectivity that we have, doesn't necessarily equate in connectedness. And so just the simple fact that, hey, I can go tweet somebody or DM somebody, that doesn't replace the human interaction of really connecting with somebody and trying to understand what makes them tick or what's going on with them or why their energy level is low. Like, that's something you have to work to do. And as a young coach, it's something that may be out of your comfort zone. You know, the coaching game has changed a lot in 20 years. And I mean, thank God, because social media wasn't a thing when I was in college. I'd hate to think what I put out there or what portrayal I would have had of myself probably wouldn't have been favorable. But man, just DMing somebody or whatever doesn't count. It's great. Sometimes you can say, hey, just thinking about you, wanted to check in. I do that all the time with my athletes if they're not around. But sitting down and connecting with somebody in a one-to-one environment is never a bad thing. And then the last piece that I would say is just like being humble and understanding that this is a long-term process. I'm 20 years in, 2 years in, I think I thought I had it all figured out. I remember coming out of college and I basically rated myself on a scale of 1 to 10 on all the things that I thought I knew. And I literally gave myself like 8s and 9s, I think, on a lot of things. And now I would probably give myself 4 or 5 on my best topics, on my best days. So I think being humble and just understanding this is a lifelong process. Like, if you want to be a great trainer or coach, there is no end line. And one of my goals growing up was, and this is arrogant, but you know, I wanted to be the best strength coach in the world. Like, that was my goal. And over time, I just started to realize, number one, how silly that was, right? It's not like there is some award for world's best strength coach, other than people that will nominate themselves. But I think more importantly is to realize, hey man, like, way more important than being the best anything is to have this mindset of being better every day. Because that's something we can all aspire to, right? Like, not everybody wants to be the best, and that's fine. But I think everybody's goal should be to get a little bit better each day. And I think if you do that, then man, you're really setting not only yourself up, but the clients and you athletes you work with, you're setting everybody that comes into your circle up for more success.
Absolutely fantastic, man. And there's a lot of opportunities for the listeners to learn from you and to pursue that 1% better or getting better each day. Where can the folks find you online? And do you have any courses or anything that you really particularly think will help coaches become better at coaching and looking at things and helping more athletes?
Yeah, great question. So I always give two options, right? Because we're all at different stages in life, in our coaching career, in our financial comfort levels. So if you just want free stuff, and you want to learn more about me, articles, videos, podcasts, go to robertsontrainingsystems.com. There is literally over 1,000 pieces of content there between all of the pieces that I put out over the years. So there's more than enough free stuff to keep you entertained and educated for quite some time. If you like that stuff, or if you want to take a deeper dive, head over to completecoachcertification.com. That is the course that I've created for trainers, coaches, rehab professionals that really want to take this to the next level. Because look, I've always said I'm here not only to make the clients and athletes that I work with better, but to leverage my knowledge and try and make the next generation of trainers and coaches better. So that is basically 20 years of education, hundreds of thousands of dollars of Con Ed wrapped into one course. And it kind of gives you all the pieces at this point, right? It's from the assessment process to program design to coaching and queuing to progressions and regressions. And the best part about that certification is it's universally applicable, right? You can use that with 80-year-old Grandma Betty, and you can use it with a high-level performance athlete, because it's literally what we do at iFast every single day. So you can either go to robertsontrainingsystems.com if you want to check out all the free stuff and learn more about me. If you want to learn more about the coaching certification or really kind of level up your skills as a trainer or coach, go to completecoachcertification.com.
Awesome. Mike, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, man. Thank you.
That's it for this episode of the Strong Savvy Cyclist and Triathlete Podcast with world-leading strength coach for cyclists and triathletes, Menachem Brody. Don't miss an episode. Hit that subscribe button and give us a review. For more exclusive content, visit humanvortextraining.com or get the latest expert videos from Coach Brody on the HVT YouTube channel at HV Training. Until next time, remember to train smarter, not harder, because it is all about you.